3.5 decades, I've had the honor and pleasure of leading this particular meeting, and the speaker tonight was able to convince me that I could go a day without drinking, and for all the hundreds of things he's done for me, I really a great deal of gratitude, and I love this man very much, Clancy.
My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here. I want to, in kind of an honor of my dear friend and baby Tom, let me just take a moment. But I must say, there's a lot of young people here. A lot of young people stood up. And there's always some old people in the meeting, some young people, like John and I and Tom, you know. We get up every morning and read the obits and see if we made it. I had a special thrill the other day. I was reading the magazine because I was in World War II as a young man. And they tell me that now something over 1,500 World War II veterans die every day. So, treat me with love. But that's the incongruity of AA, because it's a strange place, you know. Some old guy will get up there and say, "I stayed drunk around the clock for 40 years. As if to say to the little snots in the front row, "I've been around longer than you've been alive." And they don't know, the little snots are thinking, "You can't be much of an alcoholic if you lasted 40 years, you old son of a bitch." And it turns out it isn't how long you drank, even though it has nothing to do with it. It's something that makes an alcoholic is something that none of us seem to know very easily. It takes a hard time to find out. If you don't find it out, AA doesn't make sense. I came to my first AA meeting a great many years ago, and I was just out of the University of Wisconsin. I was back from being in the war. In the war, I'd learned to drink a little bit, and I loved drinking. I did very great in college and drank a lot, and went out in the world, became a sports writer and drank a lot. But I had one little problem, is that I seem to drink a little too much sometimes, more than I planned to, and I would act bizarrely. That was the term they used for me. And so somebody says, I suggest I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I went to my first AA meeting. I'm sure I felt something like way some of the newcomers here, except I was in a town where there's only 8 people sitting around a table, 8 fat old guys. One guy says, "What the hell are you doing here?" I thought, God, that's a wonderful introduction. I now know why I said it, because I was 22. I looked much younger, and there wasn't anybody in that state under 40 years old in AA. And so it was like some kid 12 years old coming in and saying, "I think I'm an alcoholic." "Well, do you? I think you have a broken nose." You know. But they let me sit around and listen to them. And it doesn't take long if you're new to know about AA. Easy. Alcoholics are people whose problem is alcohol, obviously. And they drink too much, they get in trouble, and they come to AA and admit their problem is alcohol, which gives them a sense of relief, apparently. Then apparently they return to God. Then they show their gratitude by helping others. It's just kind of a dreary, gray tunnel, it looks like. And everybody has to confront that. But it does take long to learn about AA. You don't know what the hell there's to study around here. And so I learned that in my first AA meeting. And I learned it thereafter. I moved to a different city where I was an executive of a company. And I started drinking too much. And they told me that you're going to have to stop drinking. We'll have to let you go. And I had a great idea. I said, "Oh, Mr. Carlson, you know, I got drinking in the war overseas." And I said, "But they've got this new thing downtown called Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you put me on a paid leave of absence and I'll go down there and get sobered up and quit drinking and be okay? He said, yeah, that'll be very fine. Because nobody knew much about AA. It was very mysterious then. So I went down and sat in some meetings in that city, and different faces but the same old pukes, you know. I drank lots by then. And I could see that I was never going to stay sober with these jerks, because my problem wasn't drinking. My problem was drinking provided what comfort I had. My job was trying to find a way not to drink too much. And so I looked for another job and found it. I didn't go back to that company. And I did that for years. I would work in a company, and I could write very well. I had very good things happen to me. And I would get in trouble, and they'd give me, you have to stop your drinking. I'd go to AA for a while and find another job. And one of the nice things about it in those days is you could go home and tell your wife, well, dear, I've gone back to AA. Wonderful. Wonderful. I think it'll do wonders for you, darling. What do they want you to do? Well, they want me to taper off. And there wasn't any Al-Anon then to screw it up for everybody. Since the birth of Al-Anon, there's never been a moment's rest for anybody, anywhere. Now they don't want you to taper off, just want you to stop entirely. We know it's a program of absolute being sober. We have the same steps. We have the same book. I release you, you son of a bitch. But I did that, and I went to AA, and I it's a funny thing, you know, when I first came to AA, I had a sponsor briefly who gave up on me quickly, but he had me read the book, and I read the book Alcoholics Anonymous, as I'm sure somebody asked you to do, and they said it's a badly written book. It is not a badly written book. It's a dull book is what it is. It doesn't ever get anywhere, and I read it, and I'm a writer on the way to becoming a successful writer. And it is a nice place, but I like things that have some action. Do this. Take this action. Blah, 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 blah. And you read that book, and you... If you are thorough at this stage of your development... I just gave up on the damn book. But I went to AA, and my problem with Alcoholics Anonymous always was this. These other people had terrible drinking problems, and they got sober, they felt better. I had a need for alcohol to, because I was imbalanced somehow inside of me, and I needed something to put me in balance and make me feel good. And my problem always was that I couldn't watch it. I thought about that later when I was, many years later, when I came to AA again and stayed around for a while. And I read the book again, and I read something in there I didn't even recall reading. It really is the story of my life. And if you're new here tonight, it's the story of your life, although you may not even recognize it. At the beginning of chapter 3, there's a page or two that talks a little bit about we alcoholics. And they talk about what we have in common. And you can read right through that, never identify a thing, till you stop and think what it's saying. There's one thing in there that seems to embrace alcoholics of our type. And that is somewhere along the line, we all have had to voluntarily or involuntarily accept the obsession that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. It says the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity and death. See, why would that be? But we all do it. And they go on to talk about how we fight the term alcoholic. I suppose the reason I fight the term alcoholic is because not only is it degrading, but that means I can't drink. And I got to find a way to drink a little something to get me over the hump. Yeah. And they talk about another thing that happens, dreadful, occasional brief recoveries, always followed by a worse relapse. And we've all had those little recoveries. I got it together now. I got to remember to eat before I go out. That's it. Which just gives you more to puke later, it turns out. And you keep fighting it, and you reach, there's a one delicate little phrase in there that is just peachy. I wish I'd have written it. Reach a stage of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I remember reading that thing. That's how drunk these poor people get. But that isn't what that means at all. That's how you feel after you're sober again. and people want some explanations for your behavior, and you haven't got them. The correct answer is, leave me alone, God damn it, because I don't know any more about it than you do. All I know is that you don't understand. You think my problem is alcohol, but it isn't. Alcoholics can stop drinking. Can't stop drinking. They all say, well, once I start drinking, I can stop drinking for special occasions, all sorts of things. In the mid-1950s, I was going through a bad pattern there for, I'd get a certain stage of drinking and I'd have to go out and counsel police officers. Bad move. I start going to jail quite often. Not for a long time, not like felons like Johnny Harris, but decent citizens who were misunderstood. And I got so I could get up in the morning, go home, take a shower, go to work. I mean, I really handled well. And one night, I came out of jail in the morning, and I didn't go that much, but once every couple weeks or so. And one of my neighbors was there. I said, you shouldn't have come down here. This, you know, I got that damn cop. He really abused me. I got his badge number. I'm going to get his job. He said, I don't know about that, he said, but while you're out there, we couldn't find you last night, and your little son died, and we couldn't find you. And it just about killed me, because I had a bunch of little girls and one little boy, and he was the apple of my eye, I'll tell you. And I almost couldn't stand it. We took him up to Wisconsin and buried him in his grandmother's foot of his grandmother's grave, and I put my hand in his little casket. I said, John Emmerslin, this will never happen again. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I wouldn't have let it happen for the world. And I came back, and I quit drinking. I didn't go to AA, because that doesn't help. I quit drinking. I would come home after work at night, have dinner with my kids, first time in a long time. Night after night, I'd go home and eat dinner, and after dinner, we'd work on the homework, or I'd take it for a little ride. Just wonderful. And the one problem I always had with drinking was this. I can always stop. But after a day or two, someone seems to sneak into my bedroom and put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next day, they start to tighten it. And it doesn't come out as, I need drink. It comes out as just a little restlessness, a little irritability, a little tired of the daily sermon of what I did the last time I was drunk. Get off it! Little by little, watching whatever technicolor there is in my life, gray, go back to that gray, and the job gets gray, and the people get gray, and my kids get gray, and it's just my whole life is gray. And I've spent thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis to try to find a way to break that pattern. And I did a lot of things, but I'll tell you how you break that pattern, in case you don't know. Have a drink. Oh, Jesus. Oh. But then you must remember to say, I'll watch it this time. Not knowing that you can't watch it. But this time it didn't happen. My kids and I were getting along good. Every meal would say a little prayer for baby John, like he was with us. And everything was just going fine. Best 2 or 3 weeks I'd had for a long time. And then one night somebody snuck into my bedroom and put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next morning I got up and just a little irritable, just a little tired about going to work. I didn't feel like going to work today. I didn't feel like taking the crap from those people, putting up with their nonsense. But I did, and the next day it was a little bit worse, a little more intense. I couldn't sleep very well last night. But why in the hell? Now, I'm a Norwegian Lutheran. I was born, raised, conceived, catechized, and confirmed in the church. And I was a good boy, and I got older. I'd start sinning, but I mean, I'd been very good. And it suddenly struck me why my son was died, why he'd killed. This Norwegian Lutheran God, this punishing son of a bitch, had taken my little boy who never committed a sin in his life and killed him to punish me. Well, screw you, God! You'll get me in hell, but you won't get me before that. Screw you! And that was the end of that. But unfortunately, the days kept going. And every day was getting awfully bad. And I really needed some relief badly, but when you've taken the vow on your son's casket, you can't do that. And it just went on and on and on. And one day I got up and my wife had taken the children to church, and I just couldn't stand another day of this. I pulled my car in the garage and hooked up a hose in the exhaust pipe and turned the motor and went to sleep and died. Just crazed. Incidentally, that was 54 years ago today. Anniversary time. Can you bring another cake, Tom? Upside down, this one. But I, and a neighbor next door happened to drink breakfast, having a cup of coffee, and saw me go in there and didn't come out, and he heard the motor running, so he wandered over finding if I was all right, and he found me dead in the car. And he pulled me out, and they beat on my chest and breathed in my mouth and rushed me to the hospital and oxygenated me, worked on me, and then they evaluated me and determined I was seriously mentally ill and committed me to the state insane asylum for an indefinite period. Now, that's the go-away and away when I go. When I stop drinking, folks, that's no answer in my life. Maybe some people, but not mine. And I went to this nut house in Big Spring. And I was there a couple weeks. I started to feel better, actually, because, you know, I was protected. I didn't realize it, but there was no pressure on me at all. Protected. The only thing, I had a little trouble sleeping. I don't know if you've ever been in a state mental hospital. But every time you just doze off somewhere, you hear, ah! It keeps you alert, I'll tell you. But what saved me, some big boob of a counselor said, better not ever try to escape from here, boy. Escape-proof hospital. I said, oh, is that so? Took me a few days. I found a way to get through a door, down a corridor, through another door, across the yard, and over the fence. And I was gone. And when I got out, I suddenly realized what the guy told me was true. It is true. It's an escape-proof hospital. But you don't know till you get out. I don't know if you've ever been in West Texas, but they can see you running for 3 days out there. You feel like you catch a fool in your white bathrobe. Just. Well, there goes that little Yankee sumbitch now. And they snatched me back and gave me a couple months of electric shock for that run. And after that, you never run much at all. What's your name, boy? I don't know. Check with the desk. Then in the early December, I started to come out of that. And they noticed on my record that I had done the staging and direction of a grand opera at the University of Texas that spring as one of my sidelights. So they asked me if I'd like to direct the Christmas pageant. So I directed the Big Spring Christmas pageant that year. Not very complex. The big job was trying to keep the three wise men off the Virgin Mary, if you possibly could. We just want to worship her, Clancy. And the next year, they put in an experimental Alcoholics Anonymous ward in that hospital. I pretended to be an alcoholic because I knew what they wanted, and I got out. In fact, I got to be their prize pupil. They would send me out to Odessa and Midland and towns like that to talk at their AA meetings. Attendant would come with me. Friends, I'm here tonight on behalf of my fellow patients at Big Spring State Hospital. Folks such as you have made it possible. It's as though we were going across a vast desert of alcoholism. We came to the tall green hills of sobriety, but they were too steep for our weary legs. We didn't know what to do, but folks such as you pointed out 12 golden stairs, one after another, that we can climb. And now as we approach the top of our hill of sobriety, prepare ourselves to return to our homes throughout West Texas, we wanted to tell you that God bless you and your wonderful work. You don't know what you've done. Thank you. Laugh got me out of the Texas Nut House. And I never had another drink till I ran out of Thorazine. But my problem was, I can't stop drinking, and yet I can't continue drinking. That is the great damned if you do and damned if you don't. Try new techniques. Eat. In fact, at the end of that chapter 3, there's an interesting, that little section, chapter 3, there's a little paragraph that just nails it. It talks about some of us have tried to try from one kind of drink to another, from scotch to brandy, say. Drinking beer only. taking physical exercise, drinking only natural wines, reading spiritual literature, taking trips, not taking trips, swearing off with or without a solemn, a whole bunch of things. Remember, I was sober while I read that again, and I thought, God, I've tried every one of those things except one. I never tried not taking a trip. When the heat's on, I move it out. Only cowards stay and face the consequences. But it was just on and on. And I came out of that hospital and I convinced people I'd learned my lesson. One of the things, I had to go to an AA meeting once a week, which I did. And I kept taking my medication, so I didn't notice the absence of alcohol very much. You know, I'm not drinking at all. I remember the night of my anniversary of my September 22nd, 1967. I was standing in Juarez waiting for midnight. Huh? That was a year later, goof. 57. That's what I said. What? Okay. Don't ever argue with the guy that's got the mic. You'll learn that someday, Curly. Anyway, I stood in Juarez and waiting for midnight, 12 o'clock, rum and coke. Oh, God, that was good. And I went home. I didn't get drunk. And the next morning, I realized I was kind of had a whip now, perhaps. And that afternoon, I had dinner that night, the next night, and had a couple cocktails with dinner. Went to the AA meeting to get my chip. Remember the man said, Clancy, you've been drinking? I said, yes, I had a couple cocktails with dinner. Why? He said, well, this is supposed to be for being sober for a year. I said, I was sober a year. Give me the goddamn chip. And punished them and never went back because I didn't need them anymore. And then I was looking pretty good. I got a job in Dallas at the biggest, largest advertising agency in the South. Boy, this is my big chance now because I've learned my lesson. And I was working on, if you're old, you remember them, the Elsie and Elmer ads for the Borden Company and some of the others. And I was under a lot of pressure. I realized I could drink safely now. I would stop and drink, and pretty soon I was drinking more and more, and pretty soon I was drunk, and pretty soon they were calling me in again. Just, I couldn't believe it. I was trying to try everything. Just so much pressure. And they finally called me in one morning and said, you know, Clancy, give me the car keys. We're firing you. You cost us a big account by not showing up where you were supposed to be last night, and you're not to be found anywhere. Turned out later you were drunk somewhere. You've cost us that account. And he said, I'm going to tell you something. I called your wife this morning, and I told her that you were being fired, and if she's smart, she'd get away from you and take the children. He says, I'm going to make it my business to see that you never work in advertising again. It's kind of bad to go with your morning hangover. So I got my severance check and I drank for a couple days because I realized I'd have to go on the wagon probably. But by that time, my wife had taken the children, sold the furniture, left my clothes on the front porch. I thought, isn't that just like them? One little mistake and they turn on you. But I knew I had to get out of Texas because I was signed out of the state hospital by my wife. That's the way they did it then. Your family could sign you in, and they could sign you out. I was signed out to my wife. And all she ever had to do was pick up the phone and say, I don't want him anymore, come and get him. And they come and get you. And that makes for tough around the house. You know. Are you going to take this garbage out? Yes, I am. So I knew how to get out of town. I had no car. A guy told me a couple weeks before that he was trying to get a car moved to Los Angeles. Did I know anybody that would drive a car for me? I said, no, I don't think so. But that morning I did. Yes, I do. And I said, I'll drive it out. He said, well, how about your big job? I said, I quit them. I don't like them. They're all phonies. And I got in the car, and the first night I got as far as El Paso, where I was big in Juarez, stood in the bar of the Chinese Palace drinking interminable amounts of rum and singing my little song, Yo soy el maestro de los locos en Chihuahua. And all my fans going, gringo, gringo. I got up the next morning, got hungover. I drove, got as far as Phoenix, and got drunk. I thought, I got to watch this car. I don't know anybody here, and I hid it. And I never did find it. I haven't found it yet. All my money, all my clothes, everything in that car. And I just desperate. I was looking for it all. Where's my car? Some guy says, why should you just knock it off today? I need to find my car. Help me. I'm not going to help you. Come out, for Christ's sake. Turned out to be a plainclothes cop. Threw me in jail. Said, you're going to cool me off. In that 130-degree jail, you cool, really cool off of there. And I woke up in the middle of the night so sick. Oh, God, I'm sick. Oh, I had to throw up. I went to the toilet and threw. Turned out it was somebody's bed, actually, is what it was. There was no one in it. How would I know? You know? So then I did what I'm sure many of us have done. Lay down and put your cheek on the cool tile. And, oh, God, that feels good. Oh, and go to sleep. This guy came back from wherever he was, found his bed full of vomit, and this drunken fool lay there. You damn fool, you kicked my head out. I don't suppose he meant to do it, but he kicked my front teeth out. And that was one of the few mornings in my life that I was really glad I'd spent all those thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis. I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking, this son of a bitch is overreacting. But I didn't want to say anything to make trouble. And that morning, they released me out of the Phoenix jail, just overnight again, sick, covered with vomit and blood. But I'd learned one thing. All these years I've been going to AA, I learned one thing. Whenever you get to a point where it looks so bad and smells so bad and nobody wants to see you, there's one place you're always welcome. Go to an AA club. The worse you look, the better they like it. This one's mine, Jim. So I found where the AA club was on North 3rd Street, called the Arid Club, certainly was. And I walked over there so sick, and I sat by the door. I figured somebody offered me some money or offered to help me or something. Stepped around me. And I saw some old lady trying to get up her courage to be kind to me, and I thought, such a poor old lady, I'll give her a pass. So she came over and said, young man, yes, ma'am. She said, are you sick? I said, yes, I certainly am, ma'am. She said, it was so wonderful to see you younger folks getting here before you've had to go all the way. Well, you old bitch. I didn't say that, but it cost her $20. And I ran downtown, caught a bus to Los Angeles, and hit Los Angeles, sick, desperate, maybe a dollar in my pocket. I knew one guy here, a guy named Ted Quillen, who was the chief star at KFWB at that time. They were the number one station. And I called and said, Ted, I'd given him his start years before. I said, Ted, I've had a terrible car accident. Could you possibly help me? He said, yeah, of course I can. Can you drive out here? I said, I have no car. I've smashed my car. So he showed me how to take the bus from downtown out to Hollywood Boulevard. He says, come in, see me. You poor guy. And I went in, finally got there, went to KFWB, and just terrible, grubby, smelly. And remember, he saw me and said, oh, my God, Clancy. Oh, my God, I'm so sorry. And he peeled off a pretty good wad of money for me. I said, Jesus, thanks, Ted. I'll get back. I'll get a check pretty soon. I'll pay you back. And I got a little room, and I drank for a while and had some fun. Went out to the beach, did this and that for a while. I don't know how long. And then one day I ran out of money. I called him up. I said, Ted, I'm really sick. Could you let me have a few? My check didn't come. He said, I called Dallas, Clancy, and you haven't had a car accident. You're a bum. Everybody knows you're a bum now. They'll say, stay away from you. I said, Jesus said, for old time's sake, please, for Christ's sake. Okay, so you come to the back of the station tonight. Not the front, the back. Come in the alley. At 9 o'clock, I'll come on the fire escape. If you're there, I'll see what I can do. So I was out there at 8:30. The rain came on. He said, you make me sick. Stay away from here. He threw a $5 bill that floated down to a mud puddle, and I crawled out, got it. I thought, boy, I really outsmarted him. And the next night, I went to sleep in an all-night theater on Skid Row. I don't know if any of you have been in all-night theaters on Skid Row, but they don't run all night, for one thing. They run until 5 o'clock in the morning. And they only cost about 2 bits, because they're designed for people, bums, to go in and sleep all night. At 5 in the morning, they roust you out and mop it down and just open it up again. Remember that morning? Okay, all you bums out! And outside in the rain. I thought, my God, what am I going to do? I'm going to die. What am I going to do? Some guy said, you want to sell a pint of blood for $4? I said, Christ, yes. So he took us up, took him about 8 blocks and to a blood bank. There was a group of men out in front, turned out, I found out later, they were there every morning, different guys, but they're all so sick. They're all going like, God, just a crowd of people going like this. And from the distance, it looked like they're dancing. They used to call it the dance hall. You know, all these poor old guys. We stood in line, and they let me in, they finally guys. Said, took a drop of blood of my iron, so you don't have enough iron in your blood to sell a pint of blood, kid. I said, Jesus, you got to help me. I'm sick. It's down here about 4 blocks for something called the Midnight Mission. Go down there, maybe you can get some breakfast. All right. Away I went to the Midnight Mission. Oh, God, I'm glad to be out of the rain. I'd like some breakfast, please. Guys, you just missed it. We just got done serving. I said, well, find me one more munch, will you? Because I'm so sick. I don't know if I can go on much further. He said, I told you we were done serving. Come by at lunch. We'll give you something to eat. I said, I need something now. And guys came over, one on each side, and unpeeled my hand and threw me out the front door and says, don't come back, you son of a bitch. And I tried to explain to him, I'm not a son of a bitch. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote, these Elgin Elmer ads, were running that very week in Life and Time and New Yorker and Saturday Evening Post, Vanity Fair. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. But it's really hard to explain these things in midair. I stood outside of that mission on a cold, rainy morning, and I had a terrible feeling. I didn't know what the feeling was. I know what it is now because I've seen it happen to others. You get the sudden knowledge there's no friendly direction. It's all foreign. Nobody cares anymore. Nobody's too much of your crap. And if some old guy had come up to me that morning and said, you know, Slim, you're dying. You're down to 120-some pounds. You've lost your wife and children. Never see them again. You've lost your career. They used to call you a boy genius. You can't even get a job washing dishes. Look at you. You're a mess. You've lost all your money, all your clothes. It's in that damn car in Phoenix that you lost. Your little mother up in Wisconsin is no longer allowed to accept phone calls from you because your stepfather is so tired of watching you play on your emotions. So she'll go down into her little tiny bank account and take out a few more dollars and send it to her little boy. He'd rather have her think you're dead than the way you are. And he might have said, you've been mucking around AA now for 10 years and you sit in these meetings everywhere all over the country laughing to yourself and laughing at their little steps, their little traditions and their little slogans and their little birthdays, and think, Jesus, I wish I was born dumb like you idiots. And now you're dying, he could have said. Why don't you go back to AA one more time and at least admit you're an alcoholic, see what happens. And if someone had said that to me, and if I were in the mood to be honest, I'd have to say, pal, you don't understand. I'm not an alcoholic. By this time, I wish I were. I wish I were an alcoholic. I'd do anything to be that simple. I wish my mind didn't tell me, point out what nonsense this is. I wish my mind didn't point out that there's something wrong inside of me. But nobody came up to me that morning. I just stood there. I said, where's the A Club, pal? I got to get out of the rain. He said, well, there's nothing downtown. He says, one at Wilshire and Fairfax. I said, where the hell's that? He said, well, you have to go up this hill to Hill Street. Go over to Wilshire and walk west till you come to Fairfax. Well, I remember walking and walking and walking and walking. And turned out to be 7.5 miles, although I didn't know it. I got to this damn old club, same old crap, some guy inside the door, welcome home, son. Ha, 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 ha. Oh, Jesus Christ. But I lurked around that club for a couple of days and went to their silly meetings because they were serving cake and had a terrible time. Had no idea that'd be my sobriety date. Had no idea. I had no desire to stop drinking. Tonight when they read the traditions, tradition 3 said the only requirement for membership is desire to stop drinking. I don't desire to stop drinking. You know what happens to me when I stop drinking? I go to the insane asylum. It was a suicide. That's what happens to me. And so the hardest thing, I was so close to dying. And here it is now. I've been sober ever since then. In fact, next week will be my 52nd anniversary of coming to Los Angeles. So September was a big month for me. And the only therapy I've had is Alcoholics Anonymous. It's 1958. That's a long time ago. And you wonder, how could that be? I'll tell you, let me put it basically what it is, quickly, then I'll tell you why. Because a man got a hold of me who eventually got me to listen to him because I had some respect for him. But over a period of time, I learned that everything I knew about AA was false. Alcoholics are not people who's got an alcohol problem. You don't come to AA and feel better by admitting you're an alcoholic. You never return to God if you don't want to. You don't show your gratitude by helping others. Every one of those tenets, they sound right, and they're almost right, but they're false. And I had come to learn to disbelieve them. First of all, what do you mean an alcoholic is not a person whose problem is alcohol? My sponsor was very brutal with me about that. We saw a guy at a meeting who said that he didn't work the steps because he stopped drinking. That was enough for him. He went over to him and offered to keep him out of AA. You shouldn't be in AA, people like you. And on the way home, I said, why'd you give that guy hell, Bob? Because he said his problem was alcohol. I said, Bob, I don't want to break it into you, but that's what AA is for. People with alcohol problems. People with alcohol problems shouldn't be in AA. I said, where should they be, Bob? He said, they should be wherever they want to be. I'll tell you what they do. They stop drinking, they clean up their act, and when they're offered a drink, say no thank you. I said, that's silly, Bob. I've tried that 100 times over the last 10 years. He said, maybe that's because your problem isn't alcohol. I said, what do you think my problem is, Bob? He said, it's something that sounds like alcohol and it fools a lot of people, young and old. Something called alcoholism. I said, oh, Jesus, Bob. Don't play word games with me. I look terrible, but I'm smarter than you'd believe. Alcoholism, hooray, I'm cured. Shut up, he explained. And he gave me about a 3-hour harangue, most of which I was able to blot out before I went insane. But somewhere in the middle of it, I heard something that, in looking back, subconsciously began to change my life, although I never knew it then and didn't know it for a while. He said, alcoholic people stop drinking and they quit and they take care of themselves. In this strange thing called alcoholism, which unfortunately for you and me looks almost exactly the same to the naked eye, and our mind sometimes tells us it's the same, but it isn't. This mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding thing called alcoholism. You'll discover that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to make it gradually so uncomfortable you can't stand it. I said, Jesus, Bob, I never heard anybody say that before. They said, didn't drink, and they said, stopping drinking was the answer. Nah, stopping drinking is not at all. Stopping drinking is the doorway. If all you do is stop drinking, you're always guaranteed you're going to drink again. I said, Bob, one thing I don't understand, why do these alcoholics, because I explained to them I wasn't an alcoholic, why do these alcoholics drink all the time? If it's doing such terrible things to them and they just killed them, why would they drink? He said, kid, alcoholics don't drink alcohol because it's doing terrible things to them. You don't seem to know very much. He said, now you say you've been around AA 10 years. You know that alcoholics are people who get an unnatural reaction to alcohol? Yes, I do, Bob. It's just with the phenomenon of craving. Then they drink till they go goofy. He said, nah, that's podium talk. He had a cup of coffee in his hand. He said, this was Johnny Walker, kid, and I took a big drink. The effect would be to almost instantly alter my perception of reality. The world is a softer, a little nicer place. Another big drink or two. It begins to change my relationships to the world around me. Hi there. I have a couple more drinks, and inside of me, I get taller and stronger, and they get smaller and less afraid, less threatening to me. and I'm tough, and I'm slick. I'm great. Unfortunately, I don't stop there. But that's what alcohol does. He said, alcohol has got to do something special for you that it doesn't do for other people. I said, does it do that for other people? He said, nah. Less than 10% of people who drink alcohol will ever get that effect. But if you get that effect, you're lucky and it's going to kill you. I said, my God. I said, Jesus, Bob. You say it changes your perception of reality and it makes you get along with better with people and you're strong and tough. What's wrong with that? He said, because it is not really happening, you asshole. Well, there's no way to talk to a newcomer, I'll tell you that. I said, okay, I understand that, Bob. But now, last night at the meeting, there was a girl who'd been sober, and she got up and said she'd got drunk again. Why would she get drunk again? He said, that's the other part of the disease, kid. And he had a theory that I thought was stupid, but I heard a tape of it years later, and I thought, right on. When people are born and raised, you grow up. It's not easy growing up in the world emotionally. I mean, some people grow up emotionally for 50 years. People are not interested in what you got to say, really, because you don't fit in, really, and you don't feel uncomfortable a lot. And every time you fall in love, you're not going to have your heart broken. Just one thing after another. You ask to solve problems you don't really know how to solve and deal with obsessions you can't deal with. And worst of all, you don't even know the goal, where you're going. It turns out the goal, although we don't know it, is emotional maturity. And if you go through enough grubby things, apparently, you can become emotionally mature. But alcoholics almost never become emotionally mature. Why do you think that is? Because if they have a difficult problem they have to learn something from, they can drink it away. Here's to you, household finance. Here's to you, bitch, I never liked you anyway. Hey, Mr. Carlson, take your job and shove it up your nose. And it works. It really works. I've done it all. But as he explained, the problem is every time it works, it leaves a little cold, invisible ball in your psyche somewhere that never bothers you. It just builds up to a lot of quad of it. And it doesn't bother you until you try to stop drinking. And then it is poised for action. And sooner or later, either at home or office or in the street somewhere, someone will get it going. Someone will do things like hurt your feelings, treat you disdainfully, say bad things about you. It used to always happen to me on a job. And when I was a young man, I had a solution for it. I'd quit the job and punch the son of a bitch in the face and I wouldn't have to worry about it. But when we got a house full of kids, you can't do that anymore. So you got to take it and figure out, how can I get back at this puke without being found out? And little by little, you notice that some of his friends are looking at you funny, too, after a while. Pretty soon you wind up laying awake at night thinking about these people. And pretty soon, you get to a point where scientists say that people like us can get to a point where we literally must drink to preserve our sanity. So then I drink, and then it all blows up, and they say, what happened? Jesus, Clarence, you had such a great job. What happened? Ah, they're a bunch of phonies. I quit. I get a better job. That happened to me again and again. And I said, Jesus, Bob, the way you described that, that's the story of my life for the last 10 years. I've had some big jobs, and I made some big money, and now I'm living in the backseat of an abandoned car in the AA Club parking lot taking crap from people I wouldn't hire to mow my lawn. He says, there's a name for people like you, kid. I thought, uh-oh. What could that be, Bob? He said, you're an alcoholic. I said, an alcoholic? How could I be an alcoholic? My problem isn't really alcohol. He said, alcoholics aren't people whose problem is alcohol. Alcoholics are people whose answer is alcohol. I said, Jesus. That was December of 1958. I was sober about 6 weeks. And I didn't notice any significant change in my life for a while after that. But it relieved me of one great fear. I always had a part of my head that was the fear, maybe I'm secretly insane. maybe I'm going to be goofy my whole life. And then I begin to think, maybe there's a name for this whole condition. Maybe it's a pattern. Maybe what he says is right. And so I stayed sober, and he got me to get little jobs. Pretty soon I came along, and I, one by one, took the steps and so on. And I eventually stayed sober. But I discovered one thing. If my problem is alcohol, I don't need AA. What I need AA for, if I got alcoholism, then there's no place else you're going to get it. But what are you supposed to get a sense of relief when you come to AA and say you're an alcoholic? Maybe for 20 minutes or so. But reality creeps right back in there. That's not the point of AA to admit you're an alcoholic. Well, certainly then you return to God. And my sponsor said, kid, it's about time we get on the steps. I said, Bob, I know you mean well, but I cannot return to God. I just can't. I have reasons of my own that are deeper than I can tell you. He says, nothing in AA says you got to return to God. Oh, to a power greater than myself, Bob. Does that fool the other children? Does it fool me? I know what the hell they're talking about. He says, nothing in AA ever asks you to return to anything because you're coming out of sickness. Read what it says out there on the wall. Came to believe. Came to believe. Can't you come to believe in a loving God? I said, no, I can't. He said, can't you believe in AA? I said, I like it better than I used to, but not much. He says, you think I'm doing better than you are? Of course you are, Bob. I said, congratulations. I'm your new higher power. And I could accept that because I believe he was trying to help me. But the thing to remember about that, I'm just going to talk a little bit about the first three steps, then stop. But those first three steps have kept more people out of AA than anything I know. That idea that you're an alcoholic if you drink too much and you're going to return to God. The second step says, I have to come to find a power. And that's what you have to do, too, if you're due. You don't have to know even what the power is. You just have to believe one must exist here because these people didn't all stay sober to be here so they could fool you when you finally came around. They found a power. Some people find varies. Just have to believe there's a power here in the second step. That's all. We'll do what? Restore me to sanity. What the hell does that mean? You can read 10 books on mental health and get 10 different definitions of sanity. Oddly enough, insanity is easy to define. When the human brain is under sufficient intense pressure, conflict, can't find a solution, in order to maintain its neural integrity, it will alter its perception of reality. That is called psychosis. And if you become psychotic, you usually stay psychotic. You don't go back and forth. But what psychosis is your absolute defense against. If you're all goofy, it's easy to spot you, they put you away. But mostly it's just things that have to be triggered. Like you read in the paper, God, I lived next door to that guy for 10 years. Came home one night, took a rifle, killed his kids, killed himself, killed his wife. Why would he do that? Something triggered his psychosis, I guess. But the interesting thing is that alcoholics almost never become psychotic. Isn't that funny? You'd think we'd be the number one candidates because we're so goofy. We get awfully neurotic and awful painful, but we don't become alcoholics. And I couldn't figure that out, but I found out why. Quite a simple reason. When it gets bad enough, long enough, alcoholics drink alcohol. And its number one help is to alter my perception of reality. You and I, without knowing it, have the power to induce temporary psychosis. And then tomorrow you're back in reality. And so what the second step really means, I believe what it says, it's hard sometimes when you hear about these philosophers who think what it really means is this. Those goddamn steps mean what they say. You have to try to come to believe somehow there's a power here somewhere that will make it unnecessary for you to drink alcohol. That's the second step. And the last step is a little more difficult. Made your decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God, as you understand, I would not do that. My sponsor wanted me to write an inventory. I said, I wrote to my inventory of the psychiatrist. He said, well, you got to do it again. I said, I know I'd like to believe you, Bob, but I can't turn my will and life over to God. That doesn't work. And I was feeling very bad. And one night, I was sitting up late in the club having a cup of coffee. And my pencil went across the paper, and I found myself writing the third step. I am going to try to do what Bob says, which became probably one of the more successful third steps anybody ever did, because it got me doing things that I never would have done otherwise. And eventually I came to believe in different things in AA, and its people and situations, promises, its book, its everything. But the big thing to remember out of that is that I could have died in my disbelief of God. You don't have to return to God if you've got a bad thing there. You just have to find a power greater than yourself. And the last thing I had to find out was that now I'm sober for a while, and I'll show my gratitude by helping others. False. One of the great lessons you learn in A is you get gratitude by helping others. You help others when you feel crappy and don't like anything. Help some sick son of a bitch that doesn't deserve it. You want to slap him. Love is the answer. But little by little, you get... I'll tell you a funny thing. Let me tell you. When I was about 5 years sober, I was really doing quite well. I had front teeth, smiled a lot. If any of you knew people who have lost teeth, let me give you hope. Once you become spiritually perfect, they grow back. Anyway, I was working in Hollywood at radio and television, and I was slick, and I thought, I should be a secretary of a meeting. Jesus, I now have authority on AA. So the biggest meeting in town was Brentwood. I got somebody to nominate me, but it died for lack of a second. I could see there was no groundswell to have me be secretary. A couple weeks later, someone said, over in Ohio Street, there's a little building that they have AA meetings. The Tuesday night meeting has just died. You know anybody who wants to start one? I said, yes, I do. And I went over there and paid rent for a month and wrote a little format based on what I knew and took 10 or 12 of my tattered followers and started this group. And first week we had 14 people maybe, but my announcements were pretty electric. Next week we had 22. Next week we had 30. And I offended a lot of people to get back to 12. But at the end of the year, we had about 40 people coming, regular 50 people. And I thought, I could have an election now. But that would be unfair to these people. They don't know nothing. I got to teach them. I'll sacrifice myself, and I'll just continue to be secretary and won't mention an election. So at the end of the second year, about election time, I thought, you know, they're like an emerging third world country. They want to do it right, but they don't know how. Perhaps I'd better just sacrifice myself one more year. And about 2 months later, some boob came up to me and said, are you going to be secretary forever around here? And I said, why? What's the difference? We're doing well. We follow the traditions. He said, no, don't be mad. He said, but people in other groups say that you're a dictator. And if we elected you, they couldn't say a word. I said, good idea, Billy. So I announced an election. The night of the election, I passed around ballots. I said, now, of course, you can vote for whoever you want to. You know, you don't have to vote for any particular person. But if you find someone that you think can really do a wonderful job, put them in office again. And that election, I was swept out of office. I didn't say anything. I don't care. That was the same year Tom Whelan came around and added to my heartaches. But were you at that election, Tom?
Yes.
Son of a bitch. You and Tommy Whelan, when I got done with my tearful goodbye, they gave me a standing ovation. Tommy Whelan and Tommy Carrington were the only two who sat there. You boob. Love is the answer. Anyway, but now, to show you what a good job I did in building it, even after I left, it really took off. And now it's the largest weekly Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in the world. It's called the Pacific Group. It's in West L.A. And I sit there every week, every Wednesday night, except tonight. And I'm not the secretary, but I'm the founder. Nobody pays any attention, but it makes me feel good. And after the meeting, somebody would bring a newcomer up and say, this is Clancy. He founded the meeting. He travels all over the world speaking. And he's been sober over 50 years. And the newcomer said, oh. I said, Welcome. I hope you brought your problems tonight. Many folks leave them here. And, you know, it's happened a lot. It doesn't have much effect on me except just who's this puke? And once in a while, somebody will come up and say, I don't know who you are, pal, but could you give me a ride back over to the AA hospital, to the Veterans Hospital Psycho Ward? And I think you could, nice thing about it, you could look him right in the eye and think, what? Give you a ride back to the VA Psycho Ward? You should have stayed there, you crazy bastard. There's almost 1,000 people in this room, all need action desperately. One has given all, year after year after year. I'm not just some guy in a suit. I'm Clancy Eye from up in the sky. Now I can think that as long as I say, okay. And the great part about A is after I drop this puke off at the VA and I'm driving home, my head says, oh, Clancy, is there no end to your goodness? Every time I help somebody, I feel better. That's why I help people. I don't help them to help them. I help them because it helps me. That's why in our book it specifically says, when all else fails, try to help another alcoholic. Get that sick mind off yourself. You got to do that. But isn't that an interesting thing? All the things I knew about AA sound so right. Alcoholics are a problem whose problem is alcohol. They overcome that by coming to AA. They return to God. Maybe, maybe not. They show their gratitude by helping others? Not at all. It's a funny thing. I used the steps and I took my inventory and I made amends to people. I got a sponsor who kept me going. And when I was 5 years sober, the same family joined me from Texas because I was doing so well. And we had another child, grew up another son. And they've all grown up now. Three of my daughters turned 21 this year in AA, or last year. This year, the international convention. It's all very nice. Only one of my daughters has turned out badly. She's become a judge. A few years ago, she came home for Christmas and said, Daddy, remember when we were little girls, you used to get so mad at us and holler at us? I said, sure, darling. You'd send us to our room? Yeah. She said, when you come to Albuquerque, I'm going to send you to a little room. I'm not going to Albuquerque. But I eventually worked in radio and television again, and I became quite successful. When I was 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills, doing great. And I had discovered one thing, which may be the most important thing I got to say tonight. The purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to think it's to get drier and drier and drier. If that were true, I'd burst into flame up here. You know. The purpose of AA, and I believe this implicitly, is to very slowly do what alcohol did fast, to change my perception of reality and make it a friendly place, to change my relationship to people so I live with some degree of dignity, to grow enough in self-confidence so a glance or a chance remark doesn't destroy me, to live with some degree of hope and understanding. That's a great thing. And there's only one thing wrong with that. It sometimes catches you off guard. When I was 15 years sober, I went through a little spell of that, and I felt good. My kids were doing well. I was doing well. I'd just been at the University of Wisconsin, named their Alumnus of the Year, and went back and spoke at commencement. Just wonderful. And one day I found myself swept away by this hideous feeling. And I left my job in Beverly Hills. And for the last 36 years, I've run the Midnight Mission on Skid Row, the place that threw me out in 1958. And people say, why would you give up your great career to run that mission? And there's no good answer to that. Well, it was such a significant decrease in salary, I couldn't pass it up. But this morning, I did something I'm sure none of you did. I live out by the ocean in L.A., big house, big yard. Every Saturday, 125 babies play ball in my backyard, and I'm on the road somewhere. But I got my house, and got a Highway 10 and drove through Beverly Hills down to Skid Row, this ravaged area downtown, parked underneath the building, went inside. I took a walk around the buildings I do every morning to see who's still alive and who's dying and who's new and who's not going to make it. And sometimes you find yourself stepping over the bodies of men, women, and children dying from alcoholism and drug addiction and insanity and abandonment. And we spent all day today on various aspects of how we can get these poor bastards to acknowledge there's a problem, that'll do something, want to be willing to do something about it. It's very, very difficult to get through it in Skid Row, I'll tell you it is. But once again, we get some. Last week, we had a one-year birthday from at the Pacific Group, a guy from Skid Row. And then I had lunch with my friends, Johnny and my friends, and came down here tonight and had dinner with my friend Tom and his lovely wife, and we laughed and talked about things. And I came to the meeting. I want to go home now and go to bed and get up early in the morning and do it again. Doesn't sound like a very exciting life for me, but it's a very good life. Because somehow along the way, all of you new people, I understand your doubts and feelings of different. You never had them as bad as I did or even any worse, because I had them. And I knew that it couldn't work for me. That's why it's such an unusual thing to think, stand up here and say, this stuff that I already knew about 50 years ago, it wasn't worth the crap, has saved my life because I allowed someone to direct me how to take the actions. But the great, you know, we have a circle and a triangle. And you look at, if you look inside of that, you see all kinds of mishmash. There's traditions and steps and meetings and books and people and sponsors and faculty. So if you turn it upside down, at least you get the point at the bottom. You still see all that mush in there when you're new. But at the bottom, there's a little point. And that point is absolutely as true tonight in Laguna Beach as it was July 10th, 1935, when these two guys started AA in Akron, Ohio. Here's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. It isn't what you think it is. It is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of difference at least enough so that he will begin to take actions he does not yet believe in. Almost impossible, but if that happens, the miracle starts, and people like you and I can live in the world, and I can come down here and take great pleasure in telling you how I feel. Here's how I feel. I'm glad to be safe and sane and sober. Thank you.